2. Refusal of the call. Often in actual life, and not infrequently in the myths and popular tales, we encounter the dull case of the call unanswered. For it is always possible to turn the ear to other interests. Refusal of the summons converts the adventure into its negative. Walled in boredom, hard work, or culture, the subject loses the power of significant affirmative action and becomes a victim to be saved. His flowering world becomes a wasteland of dry stones, and his life feels meaningless, even though, like King Minos, he may, through titanic effort, succeed in building an empire of renown. Whatever house he builds, it will be a house of death, a labyrinth of cyclopean walls to hide from him his Minotaur. All he can do is create new problems for himself and await the gradual approach of his disintegration. Because I have called and ye refused, I also will laugh at your calamity. I will mock when your fear cometh as desolation, and your destruction cometh as a whirlwind, when distress and anguish cometh upon you. For the turning away of the simple shall slay them, and the prosperity of fools shall destroy them. Time Jesum transeuntum et non revertentum. Dread the passage of Jesus, for he does not return. The myths and folk tales of the whole world make clear that the refusal is essentially a refusal to give up what one takes to be one's own interest. The future is regarded not in terms of an unremitting series of deaths and births, but as though one's present system of ideals, virtues, goals, and advantages were to be fixed and made secure. King Minos retained the divine bull, when the sacrifice would have signified submission to the will of the god of his society, for he preferred what he conceived to be his economic advantage. Thus he failed to advance into the life role that he had assumed, and we have seen with what calamitous effect. The divinity itself became his terror, for, obviously, if one is oneself one's God, then God himself, the will of God, the power that would destroy one's egocentric system, becomes a monster.
I fled him down the nights and down the days. I fled him down the arches of the years. I fled him down the labyrinthine ways of my own mind. And in the mist of tears, I hid from him and under running laughter.
One is harassed both day and night by the divine being that is the image of the living self within the locked labyrinth of one's own disoriented psyche. The ways to the gates have all been lost. There is no exit. One can only cling, like Satan, furiously to one's self and be in hell, or else break and be annihilate at last in God.
Ah, fondest, blindest, weakest, I am he whom thou seekest. Thou dravest love from thee, who dravest me. Francis Thompson, The Hound of Heaven.
The same harrowing, mysterious voice was to be heard in the call of the Greek Apollo to the fleeing maiden Daphne, daughter of the river Peneus, as he pursued her over the plain. O nymph! O Peneus' daughter, stay! The deity called to her, like the frog to the princess of the fairy tale.
I who pursue thee am no enemy. Thou knowest not whom thou fleest, and for that reason dost thou flee. Run with less speed, I pray, and hold thy flight. I too will follow with less speed. Nay, stop and ask who thy lover is. He would have said more, the story goes, but the maiden pursued her frightened way and left him with words unfinished, even in her desertion seeming fair. The winds bared her limbs, the opposing breezes set her garments aflutter as she ran, and a light air flung her locks streaming behind her. Her beauty was enhanced by flight, but the chase drew to an end, for the youthful god would not longer waste his time in coaxing words, and urged on by love, he pursued at utmost speed. Just as when a Gallic hound has seen a hare in an open plain and seeks his prey on flying feet, but the hare, safety. He, just about to fasten on her, now, even now, thinks he has her, and grazes her very heels with his outstretched muzzle. But she knows not whether or not she be already caught, and barely escapes from those sharp fangs, and leaves behind the jaws just closing on her. So ran the god and maid. He sped by hope, and she by fear. But he ran the more swiftly, borne on the wings of love, gave her no time to rest, hung over her fleeing shoulders, and breathed on the hair that streamed over her neck. Now was her strength all gone, and pale with fear and utterly overcome by the toil of her swift flight, seeing the waters of her father's river near, she cried, "O father, help! If your waters hold divinity, change and destroy this beauty by which I pleased o'er well." Scarce had she thus prayed, when a down-dragging numbness seized her limbs, and her soft sides were begirt with thin bark. Her hair was changed to leaves, her arms to branches. Her feet, but now so swift, grew fast in sluggish roots, and her head was now but a tree's top. Her gleaming beauty alone remained.
This is indeed a dull and unrewarding finish. Apollo, the sun, the lord of time and ripeness, no longer pressed his frightening suit, but instead simply named the laurel his favorite tree, and ironically recommended its leaves to the fashioners of victory wreaths. The girl had retreated to the image of her parent and there found protection. Like the unsuccessful husband whose dream of mother love preserved him from the state of cleaving to a wife. The literature of psychoanalysis abounds in examples of such desperate fixations. What they represent is an impotence to put off the infantile ego, with its sphere of emotional relationships and ideals. One is bound in by the walls of childhood. The father and mother stand as threshold guardians, and the timorous soul, fearful of some punishment, fails to make the passage through the door and come to birth in the world without. Dr. Jung has reported a dream that resembles very closely the image of the myth of Daphne. The dreamer is the same young man who found himself in the land of the sheep, the land, that is to say, of unindependence. A voice within him says, "I must first get away from the father." And then a few nights later, a snake draws a circle about the dreamer, and he stands like a tree, grown fast to the earth. This is an image of the magic circle drawn about the personality by the dragon power of the fixating parent. The serpent, in mythology a symbol of the terrestrial waters, corresponds precisely to Daphne's father, the river Peneus. Brunhild, in the same way, was protected in her virginity, arrested in her daughter's state for years, by the circle of the fire of All-Father Wotan. She slept in timelessness until the coming of Siegfried. Little Briar Rose, Sleeping Beauty, was put to sleep by a jealous hag, an unconscious evil mother image. And not only the child, her entire world went off to sleep. But at last, after long, long years, there came a prince to wake her.
The king and queen, the conscious good parent images, who had just come home and were entering the hall, began to fall asleep, and with them the whole estate. All the horses slept in the stalls, the dogs in the yard, the pigeons on the roof, the flies on the walls. Yes, the fire that flickered on the hearth grew still and slumbered, and the roast ceased to simmer. And the cook, who was about to pull the hair of the scullery boy because he had forgotten something, let him go and fell off to sleep. And the wind went down, and not a leaf stirred in the trees. Then, around the castle, a hedge of thorns began to grow, which became taller every year, and finally shut off the whole estate. It grew up taller than the castle, so that nothing more was seen, not even the weathercock on the roof.
A Persian city once was enstoned to stone. King and queen, soldiers, inhabitants, and all, because its people refused the call of Allah. Lot's wife became a pillar of salt for looking back when she had been summoned forth from her city by Jehovah. And there is the tale of the wandering Jew, cursed to remain on earth until the day of judgment, because when Christ had passed him carrying the cross, this man among the people standing along the way called, "Go faster, a little speed." The unrecognized, insulted Savior turned and said to him, "I go, but you shall be waiting here for me when I return." Some of the victims remained spellbound forever, at least so far as we are told, but others are destined to be saved. Brunhild was preserved for her proper hero, and little Briar Rose was rescued by a prince. Also, the young man transformed into a tree dreamed subsequently of the unknown woman who pointed the way as a mysterious guide to paths unknown. Not all who hesitate are lost. The psyche has many secrets in reserve, and these are not disclosed unless required. So it is that sometimes the predicament following an obstinate refusal of the call proves to be the occasion of a providential revelation of some unsuspected principle of release. Willed introversion, in fact, is one of the classic implements of creative genius and can be employed as a deliberate device. It drives the psychic energies into depth and activates the lost continent of unconscious, infantile, and archetypal images. The result, of course, may be a disintegration of consciousness more or less complete, neurosis, psychosis, the plight of spellbound Daphne. But on the other hand, if the personality is able to absorb and integrate the new forces, there will be experienced an almost superhuman degree of self-consciousness and masterful control. This is a basic principle of the Indian disciplines of yoga. It has been the way, also, of many creative spirits in the West. It cannot be described quite as an answer to any specific call. Rather, it is a deliberate, terrific refusal to respond to anything but the deepest, highest, richest answer to the as-yet-unknown demand of some waiting void within, a kind of total strike or rejection of the offered terms of life, as a result of which some power of transformation carries the problem to a plane of new magnitudes where it is suddenly and finally resolved. This is the aspect of the hero problem illustrated in the wondrous Arabian Nights adventure of the prince Kamar al-Zaman and the princess Budur. The young and handsome prince, the only son of King Shahriman of Persia, persistently refused the repeated suggestions, requests, demands, and finally injunctions of his father that he should do the normal thing and take to himself a wife. The first time the subject was broached to him, the lad responded, O my father, know that I have no lust to marry, nor doth my soul incline to women. For that concerning their craft and perfidy I have read many books, and heard much talk, even as saith the poet.
Now, and of women, ask ye? I reply, in their affairs I'm versed a doctor rare. When man's head grizzles and his money dwindles, in their affection he hath naught for share.
And another said,
rebel against women, and so shalt thou serve Allah the more. The youth who gives women the rein must forfeit all hope to soar. They'll balk him when seeking the strange device Excelsior, though waste he a thousand of years in the study of science and law.
And when he had ended his verses, he continued, O my father, wedlock is a thing whereto I will never consent, no, not though I drink the cup of death. When the Sultan Shahriman heard these words from his son, light became darkness in his sight, and he was full of grief. Yet, for the great love he bore him, he was unwilling to repeat his wishes, and was not angry, but showed him all manner of kindness. After a year, the father pressed again his question, but the youth persisted in refusal, with further stanzas from the poets. The king consulted with his wazir, and the minister advised,
O king, wait another year, and if after that thou be minded to speak to him on the matter of marriage, speak not to him privily, but address him on a day of state, when all the emirs and wazirs are present, with the whole of the armies standing before thee. And when all are in crowd, then send for thy son, Kamar al-Zaman, and summon him. And, when he cometh, broach to him the matter of marriage before the wazirs and grandees and officers of state and captains, for he will surely be bashful and daunted by their presence, and will not dare to oppose thy will.
When the moment came, however, and King Shahriman gave his command before the state, the prince bowed his head awhile, then raising it towards his father, and being moved by youthful folly and boyish ignorance, replied, but for myself I will never marry, no, not though I drink the cup of death. As for thee, thou art great in age and small of wit. Hast thou not twice ere this day, and before this occasion, questioned me of the matter of marriage, and I refused my consent? Indeed thou dotest and art not fit to govern a flock of sheep. So saying, Kamar al-Zaman unclasped his hands from behind his back and tucked up his sleeves above his elbows before his father, being in a fit of fury. Moreover, he added many words to his sire, knowing not what he said, in the trouble of his spirits. The king was confounded and ashamed, since this befell in the presence of his grandees and soldier officers assembled on a high festival and state occasion. But presently, the majesty of kingship took him, and he cried out at his son and made him tremble. Then he called to the guards standing before him and commanded, "Seize him!" So they came forward and laid hands on him, and, binding him, brought him before his sire, who bade them pinion his elbows behind his back, and in this guise make him stand before the presence. And the prince bowed down his head for fear and apprehension, and his brow and face were beaded and spangled with sweat, and shame and confusion troubled him sorely. Thereupon his father abused him, and reviled him, and cried, "Woe to thee, thou son of adultery and nursling of abomination! How durst thou answer me in this wise before my captains and soldiers? But hitherto none hath chastised thee. Knowest thou not that this deed thou hast done were a disgrace to him, had it been done by the meanest of my subjects? And the king ordered his Mamelukes to loose his elbow bonds and imprison him in one of the bastions of the citadel. So they took the prince and thrust him into an old tower in which there was a dilapidated salon, and in its midst a ruined well. After having first swept it and cleansed its floor rags, and set therein a couch on which they laid a mattress, a leathern rug, and a cushion. And then they brought a great lantern and a wax candle, for that place was dark, even by day. And lastly, the Mamelukes led Kamar al-Zaman thither, and stationed a eunuch at the door. And when all this was done, the prince threw himself on the couch, sad-spirited and heavy-hearted, blaming himself and repenting of his injurious conduct to his father. Meanwhile, in the distant empire of China, the daughter of King Ghazur, lord of the islands and the seas and the seven palaces, was in like case. When her beauty had become known, and her name and fame been bruited abroad in the neighboring countries, all the kings had sent to her father to demand her of him in marriage. And he had consulted her on the matter, but she had disliked the very word wedlock. "O my father," she had answered, "I have no mind to marry. No, not at all. For I am a sovereign lady and a queen suzerain ruling over men, and I have no desire for a man who shall rule over me." And the more suits she refused, the more her suitor's eagerness increased, and all the royalties of the inner islands of China sent presents and rarities to her father with letters asking her in marriage. So he pressed her again and again with advice on the matter of espousals. But she ever opposed to him refusals, till at last she turned upon him angrily and cried, "O my father, if thou name matrimony to me once more, I will go into my chamber and take a sword and, fixing its hilt on the ground, will set its point to my waist. Then will I press upon it, till it come forth from my back, and so slay myself." Now when the king heard these words, the light became darkness in his sight, and his heart burned for her as with a flame of fire, because he feared lest she should kill herself. And he was filled with perplexity concerning her affair and the king's her suitors. So he said to her, "If thou be determined not to marry, and there be no help for it, abstain from going and coming in and out." Then he placed her in a house and shut her up in a chamber, appointing 10 old women as duennas to guard her, and forbade her to go forth to the seven palaces. Moreover, he made it appear that he was incensed against her, and sent letters to all the kings, giving them to know that she had been stricken with madness by the jinn. With the hero and the heroine both following the negative way, and between them the continent of Asia, it will require a miracle to consummate the union of this eternally predestined pair. Whence can such a power come to break the life-negating spell and dissolve the wrath of the two childhood fathers? The reply to this question would remain the same throughout the mythologies of the world. For as is written so frequently in the sacred pages of the Quran, "Well able is Allah to save." The sole problem is what the machinery of the miracle is to be. And that is a secret to be opened only in the following stages of this Arabian Nights entertainment.